It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Capitol Hill, Senate lawmakers are putting forth dozens of changes to President Trump's centerpiece legislation, known as the Big Beautiful Bill, with a marathon voting session on amendments to the bill that is over 900 pages long. The president is pressuring his party to pass the sweeping tax cuts and spending package in time for him to sign it by Friday, the 4th of July. Over the weekend, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin was a key flip to supporting the bill in a procedural vote. Johnson previously spoke out against the package and called for deeper cuts for federal spending. To unpack the latest developments in President Trump's mega bill and what it could mean for Wisconsin, we're joined by Susan Johnson, associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government and Law and associate dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we speak, this marathon voting session in the Senate for amendments is still going on, and it's record-breaking for the most number of votes in Votorama history. Why are there so many amendments to this bill?
I think that the number of amendments that we're seeing, and as you mentioned, it's a record number, is it speaks to the level of concern that members of the Republican Party have as far as what's included. And it's also meant as a way for people who may be reluctant to support the bill to at least be able to come forward and say that there were amendments that they offered that were not successful, and as a way to maybe kind of justify a yes vote.
And we've heard, too, that Democrats have been forcing tough votes for Republicans. Can you pick apart those words for us and what that means?
So one of the important things that happens during these type, what, again, they call the Votorama, and is that members of the opposition party will try to put forward amendments that would make people of the other party come forward and show support for things that otherwise might not be supported by the country. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things in this bill that are the polling shows are not supported by the majority of Americans. And so by offering amendments, the Democrats also have the opportunity to try to put forward the fact that they are forcing Republicans to really put out there that they support some things that Americans don't necessarily support.
And it's interesting, only a handful of these amendments have been successful. One has been talked about that strips out a provision that would have barred states from regulating artificial intelligence for a decade. What stands out to you about the attempts to change this bill?
You know, I've been focusing on some of the attempts that I'm seeing this tension within the Republican Party in regard to some of the cuts that we've been reading a lot about as far as Medicaid and SNAP and other things like that. Some of the carve-outs that they're trying to make for particular states and individual senators to try to get their vote. But then also I'm seeing this tension within the Republican Party where some members like Rick Scott, Senator Ron Johnson, for example, are calling for steeper cuts. And so there's pushes to have amendments voted on that would make the cuts that we're seeing even greater. But then at the same time, there's others in the Republican Party who are pushing for amendments that would limit those cuts.
And over the weekend, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson changed to a key yes vote in the procedural vote. And he told NPR yesterday that talks with the White House have been going well. Let's listen.
In multiple meetings with the president, his staff, they've satisfied my requirement, which was a commitment to a reasonable pre-pandemic level spending and a process to achieve and maintain it.
So how does this bill compare to pre-pandemic spending, and how did Senator Johnson get to a yes vote?
That's a really good question, Kate. as I look at all of the fiscal breakdowns of the bill, I mean, what we see is that the Senate version actually adds more to the federal debt than and the deficit than the House bill. The CBO estimated
Congressional Budget Office.
Uh-huh. Right. Sorry. Yeah. I've estimated that we're looking at over a $4 trillion addition to the deficit over less than a decade. So I've not been able to honestly tease out specifics that Senator Johnson is speaking to that would suggest that there would be the cuts that he's referring to that got him to, I mean, there's definitely cuts for sure, but those are offset by extending and making permanent certain tax cuts. And so I'm just not seeing what the solid examples would be.
We are with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor in the Department of Politics, Government and Law at UW-Whitewater, as we check in on the developments in President Trump's tax and spending package, the big, beautiful bill that is currently going through amendments in the Senate. Turning to Medicaid, Senator Ron Johnson told NPR as well that states have, quote, legalized fraud under Medicaid expansion because of how states receive federal funds, and alleging states are, quote, rolling in the dough from the federal government. What do you make of that response?
Well, as I think most of us know, when there was the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, Wisconsin declined to take some of those resources. They were one of the handful of states that declined those federal dollars. And I would say that in this current piece of legislation, there would be about 60,000 people in Wisconsin who would lose Medicaid coverage or coverage that they receive under the Affordable Care Act. What we're hearing from many Republicans, not just Senator Johnson, but others, is that these cuts are people who would lose access, are people who are, again, committing fraud. And there's not evidence that we're seeing that many people who are on the Medicaid rolls that are committing fraud. I think that it's important to also point out that this would disproportionately impact people who are older and not yet at Medicare levels, but people who are 50 and above. And one of the things that they've spoken about doing is adding additional work requirements and additional reporting requirements. And I think that it's important to point out that the idea that there is fraud is tied in some measure to some of the way that the information is collected and monitoring work requirements and things like that. And I just don't see that the examples of fraud that are being used as a reason for making these cuts are as clear as some might argue.
I want to ask you for a moment about the Senate parliamentarian and their role, because, you know, as the Senate has pushed for restrictions on Medicaid, we've heard about the Senate parliamentarian finding some measures out of compliance with Senate rules. Can you talk about the role of the parliamentarian at this moment in ushering this bill through the chamber?
Yeah, absolutely. So because the Senate is using a process called reconciliation, which they're allowed to do for budget-related measures, what this does is it allows them to pass the bill with a simple majority, as opposed to requiring 60 votes to invoke cloture after a potential filibuster. So we hear a lot about the Senate needing 60 votes. In this case, they just need 50 plus the vice president, or 51 without the vice president. And so because only budget-related provisions can be in this type of bill, the parliamentarian is asked to rule on how any particular provision is budget-related or not. And so that person, it's a nonpartisan position, is asked to evaluate individual amendments, individual clauses in the bill, and then says yes or no as far as whether or not they are admissible.
And this bill, being over 900 and some odd pages, that would have a lot of, that would be a lot of work, would it not?
Sure. I mean, it is, and except for usually it's when something is brought to their attention and then they would then make a ruling on
it. Okay. All right. Quickly here, rural hospitals, this provision in the Senate version of putting a $25 billion stabilization fund, what would this fund, why would the fund be needed? What would it do?
So one of the concerns with rural hospitals is that, and this would hit Wisconsin particularly hard, is that a lot of the services they provide are to Medicaid recipients and those who receive services and insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And so if they're not able to get Medicaid and use Affordable Care Act resources, then the funding levels for the hospitals will go down, and then there would need to be some other way to help maintain their viability.
Susan, thank you so much for the update. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be with you.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor in the Department of Politics, Government, and Law, and associate dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. We've been learning about this marathon push by Senate Republican leaders to secure final votes on President Trump's massive spending and tax cut package and how this legislation affects Wisconsinites. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, an open letter from former National Weather Service directors warns of the dire impact of federal funding cuts. Hear about potential effects on Wisconsin forecasters and weather researchers.
Firing, rehiring is, I think, very disruptive in the goals that NOAA has.
That conversation is ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When severe weather strikes, you'll hear National Weather Service watches and warnings broadcast on WPR. People in every corner of Wisconsin and the nation rely on the Weather Service for timely reports and life-saving information. But along with other agencies, the National Weather Service is dealing with a personnel storm, as hundreds of its jobs have been eliminated at field offices in recent months by the White House's cost-cutting efforts. An open letter from previous Weather Service directors warns of the dire impact of these funding cuts. In the letter, the leaders say their worst nightmare is the cuts will lead to needless loss of life. We're looking at the potential effects here in Wisconsin. Bob Lindmeyer, recently retired as senior chief meteorologist at WKOW-TV and is a member of the Committee on the Station Scientist. And Chris Vagasky is manager of the Wisconsin Environmental Mesonet, or WiscoNet. That's a network of weather and soil monitoring stations across the state. Chris and Bob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for having me as well.
Bob, an open letter is circulating from all five former directors of the National Weather Service warning that lives are at stake here with the recent funding cuts to the National Weather Service. What stands out to you about the sentiment in this letter?
I just entirely agree with the sentiment. I think their concerns are entirely justified. I've worked a lot with local National Weather Service offices in Wisconsin throughout my career. They're wonderful. Broadcast meteorologists cannot do their job without them. So I'm very concerned, as they are, about the staff reductions that are going on.
And this letter says that the White House's budget blueprint for 2026 would essentially eliminate NOAA's research functions for weather. How much is weather research embedded in NOAA's mission as a federal agency?
It's a big part, no doubt about it. And over the years, I've relied heavily on the research that they've put out, especially in regards to climate change. So that's a huge thing. It would be immensely impactful in a negative way to the ongoing research that's going on about climate change. NOAA has a big part to do with that, with that research.
NOAA being a part of the National Weather Service, and the Weather Service has lost hundreds of positions. We've seen reports that NOAA is in the process of rehiring, some of these employees at its field offices to refill roles. Is it risky for weather prediction as jobs change hands here?
Without doubt. That disruption, it's a finely tuned machine that the National Weather Service and NOAA has had ongoing for many, many years in regards to all aspects of what they do. When you disrupt that finely tuned machine, it's hard to get it back going the way it was. So firing, rehiring is, I think, very disruptive in the goals that NOAA has.
Chris, turning to you, these cuts to federal funding and staffing shortages, they've led to weather balloon launches being canceled. The National Weather Service says it launches weather balloons twice daily from 100 upper air sites. Can you tell us what normally happens with these balloons when all is going according to plan?
Yeah, of course. So meteorologists have been launching weather balloons for almost 100 years now. We continue to do it because that is the only way that we get direct measurements of everything that's going on above us in the atmosphere. We can't install 100,000-foot-tall weather stations. That would have significant impacts on aviation and everything else that goes on, and not to mention it would be very expensive, and I don't know too many people that would want to climb a 100,000-foot tower.
No.
So what we do is attach radio sondes, which is a small all-in-one weather station, to the bottom of a balloon and let that balloon rise through the atmosphere and collect those measurements. We get measurements of temperature, humidity, wind speed, wind direction, air pressure every 15 feet through the atmosphere. And that is a huge component of the weather modeling that helps us to make predictions for the short term and for the long term.
We have one weather balloon launch site here in Wisconsin, that being in Green Bay. Do you know if the launch schedule there has been affected at all?
The Green Bay office was one of the first sites to actually have a reduction in balloon launches. That has come back closer to normal. They've been doing twice daily balloon launches, but it is still at risk if staffing shortages or funding cuts continue to be in place. Because it takes two people to do a balloon launch, and it's a couple-hour process. This balloon is 5 to 6 feet in diameter when it's fully inflated, and if it's breezy, it can, drag somebody around. So, they have these procedures in place to make sure that we are able to collect the data and keep people safe. So if there are any continued staffing shortages, funding cuts, that puts the Wisconsin's balloon launch site at risk again.
Not to mention the balloons themselves. I wonder, what is the shelf life of weather balloons? Is there wear and tear on these balloons?
So the radio sonde, the measurement equipment itself, can last for about 2 to 3 years. The balloons themselves are a very big latex balloon. So if they do have UV that shines down on them, they can deteriorate. So those do have a shelf life of about a year. So as long as we can move through the balloon launches as normal, we're not running the risk of things expiring, but we do need to be continuing to do those balloon launches for the forecasting applications.
Bob, connect these weather balloons to the work that meteorologists are putting together ahead of the nightly news.
Yes, we use them all the time. We look at those temperature profiles that the radio sondes produce to help us especially analyze severe weather. There are patterns that you look for in that upper air data in terms of temperature, dew point, all the different variables I was just mentioned that helps us determine the potential of severe weather. So that's probably one of the biggest ways that we use that upper air data directly as broadcast meteorologists. But the other part is just, again, the data that they supply to the supercomputers that run the models that we rely on every day as well.
Chris, while we're on the topics of weather balloons, do they launch at all in areas where there might be air traffic? What is communication like with air traffic controllers?
Yeah, so a lot of these are very close to airports. So the Green Bay office is almost directly across the street from the Green Bay Airport. There's multiple balloon launches a day near Dulles Airport. The Fairbanks, Alaska balloon site is on the Fairbanks Airport. So there is the potential that air traffic could be impacted or could impact the balloon launch. So what happens is before the launch is done, the meteorologist is in contact with the air traffic control and saying, okay, we're getting ready to launch the balloon. Air traffic control gives them the all clear, and then they launch the balloon.
Do they land in typical places?
So the balloons, once they get to about 100 to 120,000 feet, they pop and the radio sound falls back to Earth.
Oh, the payload. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And, you know, it gently falls to the surface. And they can fall anywhere, in farmers' fields, get stuck in a tree. So they go where the wind takes them, and they fall where the wind takes them. There is now, you know, it started in Europe, and it's now becoming more of a thing here in the United States, of radio sound chasers.
Oh.
So hobbyists that track where the balloons are going so that they can go and intercept the radio sound as it falls, and they keep it as a souvenir. They do things with the electronics. So
kind of like storm chasers in a way.
It is a little bit of a storm chasing type feel.
Yes. We're talking about federal funding cuts and staffing shortages affecting local weather coverage with retired WKOW-TV meteorologist Bob Lindmeyer is here and weather balloon expert Chris Vagasky, who manages the Wisconsin Environmental Mesonet, or WISCONET. That's a network of weather and soil monitoring stations across the state. Chris, how could the Mesonet be affected by instability and cuts to NOAA? Is it possible that WISCONET could even fill a void?
Yeah, so one of the goals with WISCONET, and we started it in the spring of 2023, was to fill data gaps in the state. So a lot of people are probably familiar with the temperature and wind speed measurements that you see on TV. Those typically come from airport weather stations, but that leaves a lot of space that isn't covered by a nearby weather station. I think of Clark County. That was one of the first weather stations that we put in as WISCONET. And there were no weather stations, no high-quality weather stations within 20 miles of that county. So we were able to get a new WISCONET station located in Greenwood that fills that data void. And we're trying to get everybody in Wisconsin within about 20 miles of one of our weather stations or an existing airport weather station, which will give meteorologists really high quality weather data every 5 minutes. So we can give very real time information as storms are moving across the state. And just the other night, we measured a 78 mile per hour wind gust in Bayfield as a derecho came across northern Wisconsin. So this has real impacts and real benefits for protecting lives, protecting property, and enhancing the economy of Wisconsin.
Farmers rely on this data. Could Wisconsin farmers be affected as weather data becomes less reliable or perhaps more scarce?
They absolutely could, especially if you think about our Central Sands region. Irrigation is an extremely important part of growing. Now, because the sands, water just drains through the sands very quickly. And so the growers, they need to know, how much water did I use yesterday? How much water did we lose through evapotranspiration? How much rain fell? So they can make better irrigation decisions. So by putting weather stations in key locations, key growing locations, Hancock and Plover in Green Lake County and Marquette County, it really helps the agronomists, it helps the farmers, it helps the backyard gardeners to know, how do I plan for my garden? How do I plan for my crops today?
That takes a reliable funding source to put these monitoring stations in around the state. Do you feel you have that?
You know, we are funded through the USDA Rural Partnerships Institute through 2027, and then the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation gave us an initial funding seed to purchase the equipment. So we are funded through 2027. We feel confident in that. But beyond that, we do need to have continued support to be able to maintain and install even more stations.
Bob, I wonder, when you retired after 45 years, did you give any parting advice to the meteorologist who filled your shoes? And if you did, is there something applicable now in this political climate we're in?
Yeah, you know, one thing that we realize, there's a lot of research that's gone on in the public in terms of with how they feel about climate change, whether they believe it or not. And the overwhelming majority of people do believe in climate change. There's this small percentage of maybe 5% that are very vocal denialists. And unfortunately, they have an impact. So when a broadcast meteorologist talks about climate change, they hear from that small percentage in an outsized way. And one thing that I've done and the station scientist committee has done that I'm part of is just encourage broadcast meteorologists to continue to speak out about climate change. Don't let that small percentage of your viewership that doesn't like what you're saying, don't let them discourage you, because the overwhelming majority of people either believe in climate change or they're receptive to listening to what you say and change their minds and become more receptive about climate change and that it's happening, that it's human caused.
Chris, someone might say, well, I can just check my phone. My phone app tells me that what the weather is doing right now, and it gives me lots of information. What goes into that, or how do we make the connection to what we see on our phone?
Yeah, you know, everybody looks at the weather app on their phone. It's, you know, the first thing you do in the morning, even before looking to see what time it is. It's, okay, what's the temperature? You know, 7.5 billion people on the planet are impacted by the weather every day. So, you know, it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum you're on, you're affected by the weather. The weather apps that you have are collecting data that is generated by the National Weather Service. It's generated by state mesonets and other groups that are out there to better understand the weather. As Bob had mentioned, the Weather Service is the group that issues severe thunderstorm and tornado warnings, flash flood warnings, all of those hazardous weather alerts. Without the Weather Service, you're not getting that information on your phone. The weather radar is run by the FAA, the DOD, and the NWS. Without them, without the funding, those radars are going to start being out of spare parts in about 10 years. The National Weather Service is working on a Radar Next program, which requires research and it requires funding so that we can create the next generation of weather radars before the network of over 160 radars starts losing the components that are necessary for those radars to operate. And weather radar is a huge, huge contributor to understanding severe weather, whether it's severe thunderstorms, tornadoes, blizzards, ice storms. So all of the information that you're getting on your phone that you're not thinking of, where is it coming from? It's federally funded for the most part.
Hmm. Bob, can you speak to the technology in newsrooms with radar and the upgrades that need to have happen in order to make those forecasts and prediction centers as well?
Yeah, and as just mentioned, the NEXRAD radars, the next generation radars, which have been around now for a long time, are just so essential to what we do and what the National Weather Service does in terms of issuing tornado watches and warnings. What they've done with these radars is put a lot of technology into them. They've developed computer programs that can further analyze what the radar images show, and they can pick up vorticities, they can pick up spins, they can pick up hail, they can pick up dirt and damage that's been injected into the atmosphere. So the next rad radar is everything. It's what we rely on almost 100% in terms of issuing severe weather watches, warnings. It's something that we rely on just extensively, to say the least.
I wonder, Bob, what are you watching for with the National Weather Service as these cuts unfold and the different reorganizations take place?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I watch carefully, and it just worries me so much, because it's just not the forecasters, it's the maintenance people that keep those NEXRAD radars running. My impression is that the National Weather Service has been dealing with the cuts that have been issued so far, for the most part, but further cuts that are being discussed and talked about would just, it would impact in such a negative way that I think your listeners will really notice what's happening. They'll notice forecast deterioration. They'll notice the warnings are not as effective. They're not as timely. It will manifest itself with further cuts.
Bob and Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That is Chris Vigasky, manager of WiscoNet, a statewide network of weather and soil monitoring stations, and retired senior chief meteorologist at WKOW-TV, Bob Lindmeyer. We've been talking about how the Trump administration ordered hundreds of staffing cuts at the National Weather Service and how that could affect weather reports and research here in Wisconsin. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, high school students in Chippewa Falls are leading an effort to bring solar power to a nearly century-old youth camp in Wisconsin.
In the last like 5-6 months, we've worked super hard to get solar on the camp, and now we're just excited to finish the project and to have the legacy of sustainable energy there.
Camp Nawakwa goes green. That story is next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. China is the third largest export market for U.S. agricultural products, buying American staples like soybeans, like beef. But the country is also a destination for many specialty products that have fewer options for sales at home and abroad. Negotiations between the U.S. and China over a new trade agreement have meant months of uncertainty. And as Wisconsin Public Radio's Hope Kerwin reports for Harvest Public Media, that's left some specialty producers worrying about the future.
The ginseng roots in Will Su's hands sound almost musical as they clink against each other, falling back into a large cardboard box that's waiting for shipment.
So this is what ginseng would look like, kind of coming in a dried form off the farm.
Sue operates one of the largest ginseng farms in Wisconsin, where almost all of the crop is grown in the U.S. The slightly bitter, herbal-tasting root is a staple of Chinese medicine, and about half of Sue's crop is exported to Asian processors, most of whom are in China and Hong Kong. But those sales have been on hold since President Donald Trump came into office and started a back-and-forth exchange of escalating tariffs with China.
We're still holding about 80% plus of our 2024 crop because of tariffs.
That's thousands of cardboard boxes sitting in Sue's warehouse. Some of his buyers are waiting to finish sales in the hope that China will lower a 32% tariff on U.S. ginseng that goes back to the first Trump administration. Earlier this month, the president announced the U.S. had reached a new trade agreement with China, but details have yet to be released. Meanwhile, a 90-day pause on higher import taxes between the two countries is set to expire in early August. Farmers across the ag industry are waiting to see how the deal will impact their products. But Sue is skeptical the agreement will greatly improve his market. He's worried that demand will continue to erode for Wisconsin ginseng, a premium product akin to buying wine from Napa Valley.
And it's very hard then to convince them to go back to something that is more expensive once they've swapped to a cheaper substitute.
China is also an important market for products that have little domestic demand. That includes pork offal, or what are sometimes called variety meats, the internal organs of a hog like the heart and liver. Because of cultural differences, exporting these byproducts provides a much higher price than if they were sold in the U.S. And around 55% of U.S. offal exports go to China, according to the National Pork Producers Council. Ag economist David Anderson from Texas A&M University says prices for offal fell abruptly in response to the tariff exchange in April. But that price has rebounded since the start of the 90-day tariff pause last month.
I think it highlights that there is international demand and that the tariffs do matter.
But some industries are worried about a more lasting impact from the continued trade tensions with China. Tony Clayton operates a livestock export company in Jefferson City, Missouri. He sells cattle, hogs, and other animals all over the world for breeding. Clayton says exports of breeding swine to China were strong at the start of the year. But after the roller coaster of tariffs and pauses, he says America's brand as a reliable seller has been tarnished, not only in China, but in markets around the world.
The damage is deep on this one. And there's not a week that goes by that I don't have 3 to 4 customers ask the question, what's happened to the United States?
Clayton says China tightly controls the sale of livestock into their country, making it a difficult market to break into. The on and off tariffs exchanged with the U.S. has opened the door for competitors like Australia and the European Union. And he says that shift is likely permanent.
I just wish we had a consistent trade policy. We start, we stop, we start, we stop. And it is just difficult to make any plans.
Clayton is working to squeeze in one sale of breeding pigs before the tariff pause ends. But he's already looking for new markets to start developing in case sales to China don't recover. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including WPR. A nearly 90-year-old youth camp nestled in the woods and the hilly glacial landscape of northern Chippewa County is the classic summer camp setting that's made Boys and Girl Scout memories for generations. Camp Nawakwa is derived from the Ojibwe language, meaning in the middle of the woods. It has the rustic log cabins and the main dining lodge, or what we fondly refer to as the mess hall. It's surrounded by miles of hiking trails with access to the Ice Age Trail and on the shores of Picnic Lake. But the camp, which is now run by a nonprofit group, is showing signs of age. The Chalet Lodge is poorly insulated and it lacks energy-efficient upgrades. The camp wants to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels, all the while educating campers about renewable energy. Now, 3 students from Chippewa Falls High School have made it their mission to bring solar power to Camp Nawakwa and take it into the 21st century. They call themselves the Green Team, and I met up with them recently at a solar storytelling festival in Deerfield called Soulstock. The teens presented a slide deck with their energy plan for the camp, and they competed against other solar projects for a grand prize of 20 panels. Senior Zoe Eckright talks about how the Green Team came to be.
We started as sophomores in high school, and we have an independent study at our school that we get allotted time to work on different projects. And there was actually a Green Team that there was before us too, but they graduated, so we kind of took over their role. But it's really nice because we have an integrated time in our school day, which is really nice that the school district allows us to have that because we've been able to do a lot of cool projects. And then we have our school's environmental club too. So we really just look for different community projects that align with what we like to do.
Another member of the Green Team, Ellie Crosby, says Camp Nowakwa is their main focus. They completed an energy audit of the camp. Spreadsheets show how to fix the problems and how much money they need to raise. Now the teens are trying to make the solar panels a reality. Ultimately, one day, they want the lodge to be off the grid.
And we are looking to put solar panels on their building. And then this summer, we will teach hands-on energy lessons to the campers there. And then our project for the next school year, hopefully we'll have it completed by the end of next year, is to upgrade and insulate and have some get some new appliances in their main building there so that it is a more efficient, greener, and a more educational place for the kids.
Throughout the project, the Green Team has developed valuable skills like learning how to write successful grants. And they're not intimidated by what they don't know how to do. Here's Ellie again.
Honestly, it's not as bad as it seems. There's some pretty clear outlines that you get with grants for what they're looking for and what they need. So you just fill out all of that, and it's like an application process first. And then sometimes it really helps if you contact the granting agency and ask them questions, and just if you look at other examples, there's a lot of tools that you can use to be a better grant writer and a successful one at that.
The teens realized they needed aerial views of the lodge to develop a plan for how to arrange 44 solar panels on its roof. So the Green Team got their drone licenses. Here's senior Chloe Johnson.
So during last summer, we got our FFA 107 license, and it was kind of it wasn't that complicated of a process, but we took an online class it was 40 hours, and it was just talking about the processes. It's not just about learning how to fly the drones. It's looking at maps and stuff. And with the drones, we have got Scanify certified, which is software that will map solar panels, the array on the building. So right now with Camp Nowakwa, we originally used Scanify. We flew the drone up to do a orbit around the chalet, which is the main building we're putting the solar panels on, to map out what the project would look like in the future.
As the teens describe their vision for Camp Nowakwa, their advisor, physics teacher Nick Gagnon, stands nearby taking pictures to document this moment. Gagnon says this environmental study course started 5 years ago, and now Chippewa Falls High School allows the students to earn credit for their projects.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that this is such a great learning experience. And it's interesting because the first Green Team, now they're all in college, and they kind of spread all over the country, actually. But they're using those skills now to get jobs. So they're already, they're freshmen in college, but they have grant writing. They've got their drone pilot's license. They've got, they have all this learning experience already that most people don't have even at the end of college. So, yeah.
It is just so incredible. And they're so passionate about it.
Yes.
That is huge, too.
And that helps. And that makes all the difference, right? Because when you're writing grants and speaking to people, if you are passionate about it, then it really shows.
How could this get rooted at other schools? How do you see this applying it in a larger scope for other schools?
Well, I hope not too many do it, because then we're competing with the same grant money. But no, in all seriousness, I think that it has to be a commitment probably on the school district and the school boards, sort of giving kids freedom to do this over a two-year time period and to get credit for it. I don't know if a lot of school districts are willing to do that. So I think we're lucky that our district said yes. Essentially, we are willing to recognize this as credit, but I think it's clear the amount of work and time they put into this is way more than any class that they do. Way more. I mean, they're traveling, on the week, this weekend, for example, Ellie's boyfriend's graduating and she missed his graduation to be here. And, that's a huge commitment on their part. So, so the kids are willing to do that, though, and because they're passionate about it, so that makes a huge difference. So.
The sun is setting, and the Soulstock Festival is wrapping up. It's time for the awards ceremony to recognize the projects vying for solar panels. Ellie, Zoe, and Chloe look on nervously because if they win the grand prize, it means they can complete the solar array for Camp Nowakwa. A representative from Soulstock begins the ceremony under a pavilion that has a roof made completely of, you guessed it, solar panels.
So these teams came out tonight to share their enthusiasm and their inspiration with all of us. And I think that no matter the results of the voting, they all did an outstanding job. Let's give them a round of applause. And in third place, the Nature Place. Thank you very much. Okay, and the second runner-up is the Great Lakes Community Conservation Corps. And a grand prize winner is the Chippewa Falls High School. All right, congratulations, everyone.
I'm like chuckling because I'm like, Ellie's crying. All right, how does it feel?
Amazing.
Awesome. It was really unexpected. I didn't think it was, I don't know. It was awesome. I'm so excited for the camp.
It's just like, it's very exciting because like we started this project like 8 months ago. And at the beginning we were like losing a little hope because it was like stressful to try to find funding. And now we're like so, so close to like actually getting the solar panels on the camp. And we were just so happy.
This camp will be changed forever because of you.
I mean, like, I was talking to Chloe and Ellie earlier, like, sometimes I think we forget, like, how much we're actually doing because we're so focused on just, like, we need to get this done. Like, it's, like, a class in our school day. And then, like, I guess today I've really taken time to, like, step back and, like, realize that, like, we're genuinely, like, making an impact. And, like, I know Miss Jasper, she's, like, one of, like, she's, like, the vice president of the camp. Like, how much she appreciates us every single time that we, like, talk to her. So it just feels really nice.
I never imagined this much growth. We ran into so many roadblocks at the beginning of the year looking for a project, running into so many funding issues and looking everywhere and just feeling like we couldn't get to the next step. And yeah, really discouraging. And then in the last like 5-6 months, we've worked super hard to get solar on the camp. And now we're just excited to finish the project and to have the legacy of sustainable energy there.
That is Ellie Crosby, Zoe Eckright, and Chloe Johnson of Chippewa Falls High School. They are the green team, and earlier this summer, we watched them win the final piece of their project to bring solar power to Camp Nawakwa in Cornell, Wisconsin. They aim to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels while educating campers about renewable energy. And the green team, they've just returned from Washington, D.C., where they accepted an award from the National Energy Education Development Project at its annual Youth Energy Conference. And now the teens, they will start teaching environmental classes at Camp Nawakwa. And those 44 solar panels are expected to be installed before the summer ends. Thanks to Mackenzie Crummy for field reporting on the story and Tyler Ditter for sound design. And a note, the Cool Yard Solar Foundation created this solar panel storytelling contest and put on the 4th annual Solstock Festival in Deerfield. The foundation is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. On Friday, Rob talked with the writer of the comic book series Revival. That's a horror comic series set in Wausau, now a TV show on the Sci-Fi Channel. And we heard from you about other works that lean into Wisconsin. A listener writes, The Doorway to Oblivion by Sal Jednoff is a collection of short horror stories. Most are based around Manitowoc County. And if you read between the lines, there are several references to local businesses and locations. And Rebecca in Madison says they're rereading When Women Were Dragons by Kelly Barnhill, set somewhere about 2 hours away from Milwaukee, where there are paper mills, a glass factory, and small fabricators in the 1950s. Of course, Rebecca says it's about dragons and mostly women becoming dragons. Whore, dragons, whatever. Get in touch with us about your summer reads. We'd love to hear from you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Rochelle Wilson, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.